Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but
hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to say a special welcome to all of you throughout the world. Each day, when we look at the world, our place in it, look at ourselves, our health, our state of mind, our hopes, what we want to do with the rest of our life. Can we change? Do we want change? What do we need to become a better, healthier, happier human being? I don't just look at that from the people living in New York or Los Angeles or other cities where we've been heard for dozens and dozens of years on a daily basis. I look at the entire world. And that's why we select the articles, the themes, the guests, the topics, and the insights that will impact you if you live in Mongolia or Paris, or you're a student at a university in Scotland. We have a worldwide audience, and we will continue to provide a really interesting mix of material. For example, today, we're going to talk about the latest on health and healing. Now, this impacts every person on the planet. How to slow down the aging of the brain. We'll give you the latest on that. We'll also show you about a simple, natural Middle Eastern sugar, natural sugar. If you've ever been in the Middle East, they use it in so many dishes, and it fights bacterial infection. We're talking about killing the infections. Also, something that is 1,000 years old that was found in the British Library, an old healing text. They actually tested it, and it kills the most powerful bacteria in the world. Yeah, the MRSA. How about that? Something simple, something we could all do. So I'll share that with you. Also share about eating fruits and vegetables with high pesticide levels, which is not a good thing to do, and a lot more on health and healing. Then I'm going from our public health segment, I'm going to talk about our trust completely in doctors and medicine, where emergency medicine is unique and exemplary, and I commend it. It saves lives. But there are other countries in the world where if you had to have an operation, you'd be much better off going, have a much cheaper procedure and better procedure, less likely of dying or having infection than the United States. I'm only going to use one example, however, a diabetes drug. Now we find out it causes cancer. And we also know the big pharma was found guilty and fined for destroying the evidence. So what does it say about the United States or any place in the world where they manufacture drugs, make hundreds of millions and billions of dollars of profit, know the whole time that they're manufacturing a deadly drug, hide the information, and then when they're caught, no one is held personally accountable? Isn't it time that we changed the corporate charter laws in the United States to hold all corporate executives who are aware of information or should have been criminally liable for this type of malfeasance, for manslaughter, so they personally are held accountable and their corporations cannot use their money, corporate money, to defend them? Do you think we would then have bad products, dangerous products, toxic products on the market? We would have the cleanest, healthiest, safest products in the world instantly. So isn't it time we did something? We'll talk about that. I'm going to do an extended piece today with a Dr. Lucia Tomlevich. She is one of the greatest scientists in the world on the subject of vaccines. I'm going to present on an ongoing basis information showing you the truth of the safety and efficacy of vaccines. They don't exist. But I'm not going to present this information today. She is standing in front of a group of scientists from around the world making a presentation. What you cannot see is beside her is a screen. Every single statement she makes is coming from a peer-reviewed journal. She's only quoting independent science on the dangers of just one vaccine, Gardasil. She was asked to come to speak before the government of Japan, and because of that, they banned Gardasil. Why is it that governments are bringing her in to testify? Her documents, her peer-reviewed journals, her meticulous scholarship is respected. you won't hear a word about her in the American media. Mother Jones, The Nation magazine, the corporate left, and they're all suck-up corporate lefts, why can't they ever interview her and look at her information instead of taking the corporate talking points and mouthing them as if you do not vaccinate, you're a danger to society, you're irresponsible? Well, unfortunately, they're not doing anything what I would call objective journalism. They've become nothing more than policy wonk hacks. Shame on them, because they've all had noble times with great articles and led the way. And now when they get into that comfortable position, at least those who are in the policymaking division, not all, you see how they become the corporate elite. Oh, and one of those corporate elite, quote, as a 27-year-old staff attorney for the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate investigation, Hillary Rodham Clinton was fired by her superior, lifelong Democrat Jerry Zeifman. When asked why Hillary Clinton was fired, Zeifman said in an interview, quote, because she was a liar. She was an unethical, dishonest lawyer. She conspired to violate the Constitution, the rules of the House, and the rules of the committee, and the rules of confidentiality, end quote. Will that make a difference? Not at all. That's just what's amazing about denialism on the left and on the right. Thank goodness they're still progressives. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Oh, and my guest today, I'm going to do a conversation with Professor Guy McPherson. He's Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, and we're going to talk about the conservationism of climate change assessment and how we might face the potential extinction of Western civilization and humanity in an awakening manner. We'll also talk about the apocalyptic meltdown. The nightmare is underway. Robert Hunziker from Counterpoint. What's happening? The water is happening. Where is it happening? Well, we'll tell you. From Antarctica to Iceland to the glaciers, and in some cases, it's happening on a very fast, accelerated basis. Now to some good news that can help everyone. We all want to shield our brains from aging because we have the largest aging population in American history right now. How many of us are there? Well, if you're over 40, your brain is substantially aged. You start aging at 27. Official aging. I'm talking about where we're going into old age at 27. Hard to believe. You got to understand the biochemistry and the neurological factors. So after the age of 40, we now have over 120 million of the population who are going into advanced age. That means you're going to see more dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's than ever before in American history. We do not have a system in place to either prevent it, except those who have been aware and are making choices, so we're going to collapse the existing healthcare system. Here's what you can do. We'll start with little things. Green leafy vegetables, salads, healthy salads. This is from the Rush University Medical Center. Quote, a single serving of leafy green vegetables each day may help dementia be kept away. Researchers evaluated the eating habits of mental ability of more than 950 adults for 5 years. Those who consume one or two servings of foods such as spinach, kale, mustard greens, and collard greens daily experience slower mental deterioration than those who ate no leafy greens at all. The brain benefits associated with dark green leafy vegetables are crucial nutrients, vitamin K, for example. And the researchers, quote, observed a protective benefit from just one serving per day of green vegetables, end quote. So that's important. Now, we know why, because of the phytonutrients. And the more mixed the vegetable variety, the better it is. They didn't mention the cruciferous except for kale, but we would mention broccoli and asparagus and cauliflower and dandelion greens and watercress and arugula. Those are also good. We would mention that having five servings of vegetable a day is the minimum I would require, minimum, and upwards of 11. Hard to imagine? Not if you're juicing. If you're juicing a day, let's say 3 glasses of juice a day, you're getting 11 servings of vegetables. And then if you take your compounding powders, you're getting much higher, and that's why we've seen such remarkable improvement in people who concentrate on getting rid of the pro-inflammatory items, because the average American doesn't realize when you sit down to a meal, and if the meal is based upon your preference of taste and mouthfeel and how you feel eating it, the things that are healthy for you, you're going to exclude. For example, when you're going in to have a big hamburger or cheeseburger or steak, you're focused upon the meat and the sandwich. You're not focused upon fruits, vegetables, herbs, nuts, seeds, legumes, tubers, juices. None of that's important. So it doesn't matter, that little tiny garnish doesn't matter. And the lettuce they use in these fast food restaurants is garbage lettuce, and it's loaded with pesticides. So that's good news to protect your brain. So just imagine juicing and starting to have larger salads, and even having one salad a day that's nothing but sprout salad. I just had this last night. I took the most powerful healing sprouts known thus far, broccoli sprouts, a whole bowl. And then I added in mustard sprouts, radish sprouts, daikon sprouts, and sunflower sprouts. Made a homemade dressing and with some coconut and olive oil, mixed with seasons and like tarragon, and a nice blend for salad dressing. Over salad is tarragon and anise seed. And you blend those together, and you put that into your olive oil. And if you want to sweeten it a little bit, you can put some little manuka honey in it. It's delicious. But just that digests quickly. It is powerful beyond belief as far as healing and preventing cancer, clearing the blood. It is a great detoxifier, and it has no calories in it. So you're not heavy in the evening, and you've still got all your energy. So let's do far more salads and juices. Now, at Cardiff University, they found something that was interesting. Dates. More specifically, when you crush a date and you squeeze a date, a thick, sweet liquid comes out. And I've made date reductions a gazillion times. They're delicious. And when you make this reduction, you can make 2 or 3 ounces of it. It'll keep forever in the fridge. And then you can add that in with all your other reductions. You could have 30 different reductions in the fridge. And you spritz it a little bit onto something you're cooking, and it just pops the taste. Well, the date sugar, date syrup is what it is. It's unprocessed. It's natural. It's healthy. Now new research shows it kills a lot of bacteria, including the really bad Staphylococcus aureus and E. coli. This is going to be presented at the Society of General Microbiology's annual conference in Birmingham. And it showed that, quote, date syrup is able to inhibit the growth of bacteria faster than manuka honey, which has previously been shown to have antibacterial properties and is increasingly used in dressings to improve wound repair. Dr. Taleb and at the Cardiff Metropolitan University, who undertook the work, identified the date syrup contains a number of phenolic compounds that form naturally in the date fruit as it matures. Now, these compounds have previously been shown to have antibacterial activity. So the syrup is just a concentration of those phenolic compounds, plus it tastes good. But who knew until now that if you have an ulcer, you have a cut, you have an abrasion, you have something that's not healing, make a poultice of the date syrup. And you can buy this in every health food store, the organic date syrup. Now, what I would do, I would mix the date syrup with the manuka honey as a dressing and put that on. Because now they show it'll kill Staphylococcus aureus, E. coli, Enterococcus, Pseudomonas. Wow, it just inhibits their growth right across the board. We could be saving lots of people's body parts, especially those with gangrene who get cut, don't know it, they don't feel it, they have neuropathy, and they get an infection, lose a foot. Now we have something that can help those individuals. So that's very good. Also, a good study shows that red grapes, this is from the University of Southern California School of Medicine, red grapes could help ease depression and what they're made from or what they're made into. Now, as people know, I'm a big believer that grapes are one of nature's most perfect foods. If you can buy organic grapes, that's your preference. That would be number one. If you can't, then get a veggie wash or make your own. You can make it with apple cider vinegar and hydrogen peroxide, and you agitate the grapes in the water, then rinse them off thoroughly, and you'll rinse 98%, 99% of the pesticide residue off. Then it's okay to eat. But ideally, the organic would be preferable. And what have they found? Now, eating the grapes, drinking the grape juice, the grape concentrate, or most powerful, the grape powder, what you're getting is you're getting some nutrients. Quote from the University of Southern California School of Medicine. Scientists have recently discovered a link between inflammation and depression, which affects approximately 148 million people in the United States. A new study finds that resveratrol, a natural anti-inflammatory agent found in the skin of red grapes, can prevent inflammation as well as depression-related behaviors in this laboratory experiment. Quote, our research is very relevant to today's society because it investigates potential treatments for people with an increased susceptibility to depression and related disorders that arise due to social stress. End quote. So, how about that for depression? And those who have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, according to the Wilmot Cancer Institute, get your vitamin D. This was published in the journal Clinical Oncology. Why? Because they found that those that have the least amount of vitamin D are potentially at risk of that type of cancer. And an apple a day won't keep the doctor away by itself, but it may be the pharmacist. University of Michigan School of Nursing, quote, according to an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, the apple has come to symbolize healthy and health habits, but can apple consumption be associated with reduced health care use because patients who eat them might visit doctors less? According to the University School of Nursing staff that did the research on this, the authors compared daily apple eaters, those who consume one small apple per day, with non-apple eaters. There were 8,399 survey participants who were involved in this, and what they found was apple eaters had higher educational attainment, were more likely to be from a racial or ethnic minority, were less likely to smoke. The authors measured, quote, keeping the doctor away as no more than one self-reported visit to a physician during the past year. So, when you eat apples, the idea of this study is showing that you seem to have a greater concern for your overall health, and that means you're likely to make other healthy selections as well. But if you don't eat any apples, then just like the people didn't eat any salads, you're not going to be as healthy. Exercising critically ill patients may help speed recovery. Okay, the intensive care unit is the last frontier for physical therapy. It's hard to exercise patients hooked to ventilators. Now, some hospitals do manage to help critically ill patients stand or walk, even if they're tethered to life support. Now, research has said that they better get on the ball and get these people into mobility therapies. So, no matter what the condition, you got to use their muscles or they waste away. And so, get them up and get them moving, even if you have to help them and do whatever you have to do. Don't let people lay in bed. And finally, can kimchi alter the gut microbiota and influence metabolism? This is from the Dongguk University and Seoul National University in Seoul, Korea. Quote, consuming fermented kimchi, KMCHI, a source of lactobacilli, may alter the composition of bacterial populations in the gut and affect metabolic pathways of obese women. That's good. This was published in Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. What it means is that the bacteria in the kimchi is good for your body. Developing a taste for this is a different matter. Whoa, my least favorite food, kimchi. However, it is good for you. And if I had no other fermented food or no other source of bacteria, good bacteria, probiotics, I would use it. But unfortunately, I have 100 other things I could take rather than eat something that tastes like, you know, 3-year-old athletic socks that have never been washed. So much for kimchi. But it's good for you if you don't mind that taste. I just happen to very much mind that taste. This is from Robert Kennedy. Quote, we need to start calling this epidemic what it is, the autism holocaust. Hitler's holocaust consumed 6 million Jews, gypsies, and gays. Pol Pot's holocaust murdered 2 million Cambodians. The autism holocaust has already destroyed 1 million American children and many millions around the world. Holocaust is a Greek word meaning consumed by fire. It is the translation of the Hebrew term describing the burning sacrifice of valuable animals, or in the case of Abraham and Isaac, a child for the greater good. Holocaust deniers within the CDC and its acolytes, Paul Olfit, and front groups, Autism Speaks, promote Goebbels' big lie. The epidemic is the artifact of better detection. We need to put an end to this fraud. Autism parents know that the disease is far more devastating than the death of a loved one. Autism permanently robs its victims of their right to live joyful, happy, productive lives. It traps them in a prison of social isolation as desolate as any dungeon. It condemns them to diminished lifetimes characterized by agonizing pain comparable to the worst form of torture. And while the death of a human devastates loved ones, full-blown autism permanently debilitates entire families. One of the reasons our movement lacks political power is that the families of autistic children are so drained emotionally, spiritually, and financially from the ordeal and the demands of caring for the brain-injured child that they have little energy left for political activism. They become politically invisible. Parental exhaustion leaves brain-injured children even more vulnerable and less protected by institutional safeguards. There are many tribulations that all of you have learned to endure, but none of us should have to put up with Holocaust deniers like Colleen Boyle and Paul Offit telling us that the agonizing ordeal you suffer each day is not actually happening. We need to start calling Autism Awareness Month by another name, Autism Holocaust Acknowledgement Month. You have the right to call it a holocaust, and I want to debate the guy who claims you do not. That's a debate our whole country needs to hear. End quote, Robert Kennedy, Jr., on the Alliance of Vaccine Awareness. And I would share this with you. When you look at 2 million parents who have the 1 million children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, on the one hand, you have their experience. The vast majority of these parents will say, my child was developing normally until the vaccines, and then went into this dark place. On the other hand, you have the CDC, the FDA, the entire pharmaceutical industry, and saying, no, one had nothing to do with the other. One was not causative. We now have outstanding evidence that one did cause the other. The aluminum, the number of vaccines, the mercury, the susceptibility of the child at the genetic level, other contaminants like glyphosate, the herbicide, all of these can be disruptive to a very vulnerable immune system. This is from Brian Shohavy, Health Impact News. Quote, why is the mainstream media ignoring measles vaccine fraud cases? The current measles outbreak and measles vaccines are a hot topic of debate raging in both the mainstream and alternative media. However, it would appear that the mainstream media's reporting on this issue is leaving out some very important facts that, for some reason, they don't seem to want to report. Given the severity of the issue and the current rhetoric, which includes some of the mainstream media calling for criminal prosecution, incarceration of parents who refused the measles vaccine, it's very important that all the facts involving the measles vaccine are revealed to the public. Unfortunately, one topic in the discussion about measles vaccine that the mainstream media is completely ignoring is the fact that whistleblowers have come forward to reveal massive fraud connected with the current measles vaccine. First, as we have mentioned several times in our coverage of this issue, there is currently a no measles vaccine available. If one desired to get a measles vaccine, or if one is mandated by law to do so, there is currently only one vaccine available, and it is a combination of three vaccines, measles, mumps, and rubella. One company owns the rights to that, Merck. What the mainstream media is not currently reporting, however, is that Merck has been involved in a long federal lawsuit with allegations of fraud over their mumps portion of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. In a case filed back in 2010 by two whistleblowers, virologists who worked for Merck, Merck has apparently tried hard to get this case thrown out of court and keep this news out of the media. But late in 2014, a federal judge finally ruled that the case is to move forward. We had to obtain this news from legal websites providing news to attorneys, as we could find no mention of this in the mainstream media. The memorandum issued by the judge in district court explaining his ruling is found here. Since this case has been languishing in the courts for 5 years now, there are older reports in both the mainstream and alternative media that exist. This is from Forbes, way back in 2012. Quote, "Anyone who falls on either side of the debate about vaccines' alleged potential to cause harm is sure to have heard the big news this week, the unsealing of a whistleblower suit against Merck, filed back in 2010 by two former employees accusing the drug maker of overstating the effectiveness of its mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine. The scientists claim Merck defrauded the U.S. government by causing it to purchase an estimated 4 million doses of mislabeled, misbranded MMR vaccine per year for at least 10 years, and helped ignite two recent mumps outbreaks that the allegedly ineffective vaccine was intended to prevent in the first place. Quote, as the single largest purchaser of childhood vaccines, accounting for more than 50% of all vaccines purchased, the United States government is by far the largest financial victim of Merck's fraud. But the ultimate victims here are the millions of children who every year are being injected with a mumps vaccine that is not providing them with an adequate level of protection against mumps. And while this is a disease the CDC targeted to eradicate by now, the failure in Merck's vaccine has allowed this disease to linger and with significant outbreaks continuing," end quote. The Wall Street Journal also covered the story back in 2012, but according to a report, the Wall Street Journal's elite network of CFOs from the world's top corporations met 3 days later, including executives from Merck, and the story was removed from the Wall Street Journal website. Here's some more information about the lawsuit provided by the Courthouse News Service. Quote, Merck is the only manufacturer licensed by the FDA to sell mumps vaccine in the United States, and it could not show that the vaccine has 95% effectivity. It risked losing its lucrative monopoly, according to the complaint. That's why Merck found it critically important to keep claiming such a high efficacy rate, the complaint states. And Chatham claims that why Merck's went to great lengths, including, quote, manipulating its test procedures and falsifying the test results to prop up the bogus figures, though it knew that the attenuated virus from which it created the vaccine have been altered over the years during the manufacturing process, and the quality of the vaccine had degraded as a result. Starting in the late 1990s, Merck set out on this sham testing program with the objective of, quote, reporting efficacy of 95% or higher, regardless of the vaccine's true efficacy, the complaint state. Dr. Chatham says Merck initially called its testing protocol 007. Under protocol 007, Merck did not test the vaccine's ability to protect children against a wild-type mumps virus, which is the real-life virus against which vaccines are generally tested. Instead, listen carefully. This is from the court documents. Merck tested children's blood using its own attenuated strain of the virus. This is the same mumps strain with which the children were vaccinated. This subverted the process and the purpose of the testing regime, which was to measure the vaccine's ability to provide protection against the disease-causing mumps virus that a child would actually face in real life. The end result is deviation. Was that Merck's test overstated in the vaccine's effectiveness? End quote. Now, Merck also added animal antibodies to blood samples to achieve a more favorable test result, though it knew that the human immune system would never produce such antibodies and that the antibodies created a laboratory testing scenario that, quote, did not in any way correspond to, correlate with, or represent real-life virus neutralization in vaccinated people. Dr. Chatham claims the falsification of test results occurred, quote, with the knowledge, authority, and approval of Merck senior management, end quote. So, here's a question for The Nation magazine and for Mother Jones and all the others and all the people who think they have some idea of the truth of this. Why haven't you reported this? It's a matter of fact. It's a matter of record. It's in the legal proceedings. Why didn't you show that the company that is the only one making this vaccine? So no matter what part of the argument you're on, you have to get their vaccine. The company is engaged in fraud. Why didn't you let them know this is the same company that caused the death of so many with Vioxx, tens of thousands? They lied there. They have pathologically lied. They've settled all kinds of lawsuits. Look at their background. Look at their history. If you call yourself a journalist and not just a reporting propagandist, then do what those of us who are actual real journalists do. We go out and we look for the truth no matter where it is, no matter what it shows, and you report it honestly and to the best of your ability. You have not done that on this issue. Maybe other issues you have. Absolutely good for you on those, but not on this one. You're on the wrong side of the truth in history. But the trouble is the left has such hubris, it has such arrogance, it has such conceit that it never acknowledges when it's wrong. It would rather take a group of people, put them in a circle, everyone priding themselves in how left they are, and shoot each other in the head, a circular suicide. That's the best that these clowns can ever do. And you wonder why people don't trust you, believe you, because you're not capable of showing that when the truth needs to be shown, show it. Show the truth. And if you can't, then you do not deserve the respect that you assume that you have because you've been around so long. Why didn't you challenge the CDC on its entire vaccine autism program when its leading scientist on autism at the CDC, hence the top man in America on the official position of autism in the CDC in vaccines, showed that he lied? He came forward, Dr. William Thompson. Why wasn't this reported? Quote, in one of the biggest stories in the past 10 years that the mainstream media did not cover in 2014 was the story of Dr. William Thompson, a senior epidemiologist at the CDC who co-authored and published research on the MMR vaccine from the CDC back in 2004, and his decision to become a whistleblower and reveal data that was concealed by the CDC linking the MMR vaccine to autism among African-American boys. Dr. Brian Hooker, recently interviewed by Dr. Gary Nall on his national radio broadcast, January 2019, and Dr. Nall writes, quote, in the Obama era, when whistleblowers are persecuted more than ever before, it is an act of great courage for a person to come forth and reveal government malfeasance, corruption, and criminal behavior. Therefore, it was a shocking surprise last year when a senior epidemiologist at the CDC, Dr. William Thompson, acted upon his moral conscience and released thousands of pages of CDC documents with research data to Congress that unveiled the agency's long history of fraudulent studies and medical cover-ups that hid the serious failures of the health risk of vaccines. Dr. Thompson is a distinguished scientist who has worked at the CDC since 1998. Dr. Brian Hooker, a specialist in molecular and cellular systems and the first person to be contacted by Dr. Thompson, stated during a recent broadcast that the released documents are not simply a smoking gun, rather it is a wildfire. Dr. Thompson is currently cooperating with members of a congressional subcommittee. Thousands of American parents and vaccine-damaged children suffering from permanent neurological impairment of autism await a trial that will finally bring to justice many of the nation's top health officials. Is this big news? It most certainly is. Perhaps the biggest news story regarding vaccines in over 10 years. But you will not find any mention of this in the mainstream media. Why? Conclusion. Do not trust the mainstream media. By the way, I would say do not trust any of the left media, corporate left, because it's now, if you're not corporate left, you're excluded. You're marginalized. And that's unfortunate. Instead of reporting the news on MMR fraud claims made by whistleblowers, what will the mainstream media, doctors on television, reporters, news anchors, vilifying parents who refuse to accept the claims made by medical authorities regarding a vaccine associated with alleged massive fraud and conflict of interest? Vaccines cannot survive in a free market. Based upon their own merit, therefore, the U.S. government buys most of the vaccines manufactured in the United States. The CDC currently spends $4 billion purchasing vaccines from drug makers and wants to increase that amount to another billion this year. The CDC is the largest purchaser of vaccines, and all at taxpayer funds, making the pharmaceutical industry's extreme amount of money. The CDC has an obvious conflict of interest in producing vaccine data and has been caught in the past inflating statistics to promote vaccine sales. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services under President Obama, admitted in an interview with Reader's Digest that the government puts pressure on the mainstream media not to give equal weight to those who question the science of vaccines. What can be done about public mistrust of vaccines? There are groups out there that insist that vaccines are responsible for a variation of problems despite all scientific evidence to the contrary. So what you have to do is be honest and open and look for the independent science and have them once and for all prove that vaccines are safe and effective. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I am Gary Nall. Needless to say, when the people who are pro-vaccines left and right come out, they attack the parents, they attack the advocates, they attack for open and honest science, they attack any truth. What do we have on our side? We don't attack them. We attack their lack of science, showing you the proof. Fraudulent criminal activity. So if you want to continue to have vaccines believing in their fraudulent information, that's your choice. That's your freedom of choice. Let's now say hello to a man who has stood up against a lot of the misinformation or the intentionally ultra lowballing of the problems with the environment, Professor Guy McPherson. He is a professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology, University of Arizona. He specializes in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change and their economic consequences. He has also taught at Texas A&M University and University of California, Berkeley. He is also an author, and his latest co-written book with Carolyn Baker entitled Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. He is also the co-host of the radio program, one of the most popular, I might say, on the Progressive Radio Network, Nature Bats Last. Heard every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His website is guymcpherson.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's great to be with you again.
I don't have the time today to read it, but there's a very good article that we posted today by Robert Hunziker from Counterpunch called Apocalyptic Meltdown, The Nightmare is Underway, and it talks about the water melting in Antarctica, the Arctic, the Greenland, but he's talking about how it's melting at a cataclysmic rate. In fact, He says that there's no accurate way of predicting how soon we're going to see the oceans rise substantially. But he says that there's some, for example, quote, according to scientists, the Totten Glacier, 90 miles long and 20 miles thick, containing enough water to raise sea levels 11 feet, is irreversibly cascading into the ocean. And that's from a scientific journal. And it doesn't, what we don't know is how long it will take for all these melting glaciers or parts of Antarctica or parts of Greenland to melt that will then see this rise. Now, here's the issue. Some say, yeah, that's occurring, but it's going to be 200 years, 300 years before it raises, you know, the ocean maybe 3 feet. There are others who say, we don't know how long it could take, but based upon the concept of not knowing, having no accurate mathematical model, being in chaos theory, we could go to sleep, you know, next month, and a gigantic chunk of Antarctica could slide into the ocean based upon the pressure of melting and then the cascading movement of this ice. We have no way of determining when this will happen. Where do you come down after looking at the research on the rising sea levels?
Well, you're absolutely right. It could happen literally any day. That's a lot of ice. And for many years, the West Antarctic Ice Shelf was the primary attention of focus by the scientific community. But more recently, okay, so let's take a look at the West Antarctic. This from the March 26th issue of Science, just 5 days ago, quote, West Antarctic losses increased by 70% in the last decade, and earlier volume gained by East Antarctic ice shelves ceased. And so now the East Antarctic ice shelf has entered the lexicon of the scientific community. The March 16th online issue of Nature Geoscience identifies melting from below on the Totten Glacier, as you mentioned just a few minutes ago. So it's pretty evident that Antarctica, which mainstream climate scientists thought was absolutely untouchable until the last few months, it's clear that Antarctic ice is following the path of Arctic ice. It's going away and a lot faster than anybody thought just a few months ago, much less a few years ago. This is a very, very big deal. Arctic ice, when it melts, of course, it's floating, so it doesn't contribute to sea level rise. But Antarctic ice is almost all on land, so when it melts or when a big chunk of it drops into the sea, average sea level increases profoundly, catastrophically, and potentially quite suddenly.
So the truth of it is we have no way of knowing right now when this perfect storm of melting underneath, and now they have new evidence that Antarctica has heated up in the bottom probably from some form of volcanic activity in that area. So it's warming up underneath. They have giant lakes in Antarctica, which are huge. And when all this starts to coalesce and melt, what is in the front that has been holding it back, like backstopping it, when that breaks off and goes into the ocean, everything behind it can slide right in too.
Exactly. And Greenland is a model for this. Greenland has been studied for a little bit longer, and we're seeing the exact same processes play out in Greenland as we are in Antarctica. When the dam breaks, there's really no telling how much sea level rise is going to occur or how abruptly. But, you know, it could be literally any time, particularly in the southern hemisphere summer. So, for example, I think it was just 2 days ago, Antarctica set an all-time record for high temperature, 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That broke the record from a day earlier that it set the all-time record. That's 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit. This is Antarctica. It's supposed to be frozen essentially all the time there. The most recent temperature readings are 30 degrees Fahrenheit above average on a recurring basis. So this is astonishing. This is nothing short of astonishing that we have this enormous ice mass that is experiencing very high temperatures, well above freezing, obviously, and there's melt from below due to volcanism, as you pointed out. The dam's about to break. It could go just about any time. I think what's more astonishing about this, although I shouldn't be so optimistic at this point in my life, I think what's more astonishing is that the mainstream media haven't noticed any of this yet. The mainstream media were reporting things in 2007, 2008 that they won't even touch anymore. And here I'm thinking about things like the clathrate gun, which was the focus of a piece on MSNBC in 2007. And now you'd never know by watching MSNBC or the other mainstream media outlets that there was such a thing as methane leaking out of the Arctic Ocean. So it's just amazing the ongoing failure of the corporate media to report issues of significance.
Okay. I'd like to go through several issues very quickly. First, we've been led to believe that the United Nations, the United Nations Climate Convention is the all-time authority. They have all the best information. Their Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. But many of us challenge that. We believe that they're coming up with the most conservative, non-threatening information to release to the public, where privately, when you get them aside, and I have top sources at the UN, I mean at the top level at the UN that I speak with, and they'll tell you, oh, no, on a one-on-one basis, they'll tell you it's all hell's going to break loose and the public is going to be caught completely by surprise because they're afraid to panic people, to tell them the truth, so they give them a homogenized, blanderdized, kind of easy to take, well, yeah, things are bad, but not that bad, and it can be corrected. We got plenty of time. You know, we can do a treaty that is voluntary now, but at some point might be mandatory to have them kind of lessen, possibly a little bit, but not too much. The Koch brothers, we don't want to cause them too much. They'll go through this scenario with you. And then they say, but then the truth is, we're faced for one badass beatdown any day now. Your thoughts?
Well, a couple of things. The IPCC's efforts over the last 20 years with respect to climate risks have been badly underestimated. I would even argue that they've failed miserably. They use a very conservative approach. As pointed out even in the September 2014 issue of the American Meteorological Society. So they, in their vaunted assessments, they rely upon 7 to 10-year-old information, and then after the scientists are done, the information is substantially watered down through the political process. So there's a bunch that is wrong with their what I would consider a faulty and very conservative approach. For example, the mention of methane one time, twice in a single table in their fifth assessment, only to point out that it's a problem to be solved by future generations. And so
you've made the point. I'm going to ask you one last question. It's going to take a little bit of time, but it's a little longer question because I think it's not being asked out there, and that is, having become disillusioned, as you have, with how corrupt science can become and how it can take the truth and alter it to suit some political or economic agenda, when you look at the world today, the entire world, remember, we're broadcasting all over the world right now. I'd like you to explore some of the deeper psychological aspects of the rapid pace of climate change that we are witnessing. We're witnessing more tipping points being reached. In one sense, as tipping points are observed, we enter more of a twilight zone of unknowing about what ultimate results lie ahead. We still don't fully understand the synergistic effects between the various climate change metrics that are investigated when they converge or enter a chaotic state, and we're there now. What does seem very certain is that human life is faced with a possibility that parts of it will become extinct in the very near future. I'm talking about 15 years, or at least Western civilization and modern societies, we know them, will be challenged, and the world that we see today, when you look out your window today, if you live in California, you're not going to see anything resembling a calm and a passionate, sustainable life in 15 years. But I'm seeing New York City will be changed. Washington, D.C. will be substantially changed because of the rising waters. We're not building levees. We're not doing anything because we don't want to terrify people. So give us your assessment of what you see the worst possible scenario, but realistic being, and where are the problems coming from?
The worst case scenario for our species is that we go extinct in the very near term as a result of loss of habitat. The worst possible scenario for the remainder of the living planet is that in our greed and our hubris, we manage to continue taking out 150 to 200 species a day, driving them to extinction. That's what's going on now. It seems to me that the only way to turn that around is the collapse of industrial civilization. But the collapse of industrial civilization leads to the catastrophic meltdown of the world's 400 and change nuclear facilities. That's going to be inconvenient, especially the catastrophic fires that result when the spent fuel rods are exposed to the air. And that collapse also unleashes a horrifically rapid global average rise in temperature as a result of the absence of global dimming. All of that seems perfectly in play to me. I don't see any way we can sustain the unsustainable indefinitely or even beyond a few years from now. So it looks to me that we're at the end of the run. How did we get here, and who's to blame? Well, it's pretty apparent that the corporate media and the corporate governments, the corporatocracy in general, are responsible for misinformation, disinformation, and failure to report on the topics that actually matter. You look at what's trending, for example, on your Facebook feed, and you see the most absurd, surreal, personal stories about celebrities in this celebrity culture. It's so disjointed from reality as to make me wonder whether it's me that's lost my mind or essentially everybody else on the planet. You don't need to answer that for me, by the way.
What I'd like to do is this. I would like to set aside an hour on the Progressive Commentary Hour to discuss the solutions. You've painted a picture here, and I have been working on an important documentary and a major book on the tipping point, so I'm fully familiar with the scenario. I do see that there's a possibility for hope for those who are willing to make changes. I do not see any hope for those who are in denial or could care less or dismissive of it. I do see this happening a lot sooner than what people might anticipate, and around the world it's happening now to people. We just don't pay attention to the 120,000 unique events each year that happen with weather, flooding and hurricanes, typhoons and earthquakes, volcanoes. We don't pay attention to it anymore. It's like it's a non-event. There was a 7.7 earthquake in Papua New Guinea today. It didn't cause a tsunami, which is good, but it didn't even make the news media. I get information from a source on all climatic things every single day, as I'm sure you do as well. So we're up on this. So let's talk about what the solutions are. What can we do? Not to ascribe blame. We know who was responsible, as you just capsulized. But now let's look at the solutions. Are you up for that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Then let's get you on the Progressive Commentary Hour, where we have a whole hour uninterrupted to look at how we can save the planet, life, humans, those who even help those people who don't want to help themselves. That's one of the ironies of our journey. Professor Guy McPherson, my guest, and we look forward to talking with you in the near future. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.